The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hi, good morning. Welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you this morning again, and glad to have you on board. It's Friday, August 9th, and we are live here in the WTBR studio. We have a great show for you today. We're going to be talking money today. We have Mr. Alan Harris, the CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Berkshire Money Management. And, you know, with the volatility recently in the stock market and some things that people probably have noticed about things like that, whenever that kind of news gets out there, we want to talk to people about how people should react to something like that. And so that's one of the things we'll talk to Alan about this morning. Also about AI and some of the other things that are happening in our economy right now. So looking forward to that conversation with Alan. First, let's go to the weather forecast and see what is in store for us. You know, spoiler alert, I think you're going to hear something about rain. Here it comes. Berkshire weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, cloudy. A chance of showers with a slight chance of thunderstorms this morning, then showers with a chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs in the upper 70s. Southeast wind 15 to 20 miles per hour. Gusts up to 35 miles per hour this afternoon. Chance of rain 80%. Tonight, showers with a chance of thunderstorms in the evening, then showers likely after midnight. Locally heavy rainfall possible in the evening. Humid with lows in the mid-60s. South wind 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts up to 40 miles per hour, becoming southwest with gusts up to 30 miles per hour after midnight. Chance of rain 90%. Saturday, mostly sunny. Highs around 80. West wind 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Well, I guess the best news in that weather forecast is that we get some sunny weather tomorrow. That's the best we can do for you. 80% chance of rain and thunderstorms today. That's the remnants of Debbie coming through. I guess not as bad as they're going to get out in central and western New York and up into Burlington, Vermont, in that area. So we kind of dodged the bullet there a little bit. We're still going to get some rain. I hear about 2 inches of rain is expected. So umbrellas and raincoats for sure today, and no mowing the lawn, that's for sure. So thanks again for being here this morning on Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR FM. Alan Harris, good morning, sir. How are you? And thanks for coming in today.
Good morning. I am currently dry, but I will be wet later on. Thank you for having me, by the way.
Have any outdoor plans today?
Yeah. Today is actually our annual summer bash for Berkshire Money Management.
Oh, wow.
And, but we had planned on having a water slide anyway, so we were going to get wet. I had already had my sandals and swimming short ready.
There you go. Well, for something like that, I'm sure you plan for all the, you know, tents and you got to plan for rain right?
We're just going to jump in the puddles.
There you go. That'll work. Well, you know, what else to do in the summer? And you never know what you're going to get. So again, thanks for coming in. Obviously, in the last week or so, we've seen kind of a shift, a change in some of the stock market activity. I'd say that the volatility in the market has risen. And tell us what the trigger for that was, because it seemed like it was kind of sailing along, smooth sailing, and all of a sudden there was a ripple. What happened?
Yeah. So, well, first, just to describe the magnitude of the volatility, and it can be measured in a couple of different ways. One is just simply price movement of stocks. NASDAQ shifted maybe 11% over a week and a half, and S&P 500 about 8.5% over a similar amount of time. So actually that number, although quicker than a typical garden variety kind of correction, that is very, very regular for any given calendar year. But what was exceedingly shocking was a measurement called the VIX. The volatility index is tracked by the Chicago Board of Exchange, and it's nicknamed the Fear Index. And what it does is essentially just a kind of bullet point. It measures the expected volatility. It measures what type of variation in stock prices you're going to see. And you know, that's it builds on the fear of people as they're no longer complacent. They expect something sort of radical to happen. And it spiked, the VIX did, from about 25-ish to 65.3. It didn't close there, but it hit that.
And that's a big move, right?
Yeah. So it's
in a very short period of time.
It's a very big move in a very short period of time, which is telling in itself. But also, you know, numbers alone don't matter unless there's comparison. And it hit a similar number, probably a little less, actually. In lots of different times at the peaks of falling at the bottom of market corrections or even bear markets. You might have got 40, 45. Sometimes it touched 50. So 65.3 was a lot more than even like 20, 25, 30% declines that occur over a year-ish or so. But there were also big spikes in the great financial crisis, 2008, 2009, and during the COVID crash. And those are the only two times in which the VIX were higher.
Wow.
So 65.3, shrug, who does that mean? It essentially means that people were more scared, more freaked out, investors in particular, were more scared, more freaked out than any other time than those two crazy moments.
And the two basic forces of the market are greed and fear,
sure,
right?
Absolutely.
So the VIX is measuring the fear factor, essentially.
So you ask sort of what triggered that.
Yeah.
Any movement in stock markets tend to say, demand, give me some explanation of what happens. And a lot of times it's kind of quasi-made up, but I think in this particular instance, it's more real than not. And for something that's real to trigger a movement like that, you have to have other factors that are in play. You know, you can't prove a counterfactual, and you always have to think about in semper paris, all other things created, all other things equal. But given where the market was, there was a trigger that made that happen, and the trigger was the Bank of Japan raising their version of the federal funds rate. They're raising interest rates. So here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve dictates what the federal funds rate is. The Bank of Japan raised what is their version of that.
And they raised it at a time where the U.S. Fed is actually considering cutting, right?
And other developed nations have also, too.
Yeah.
So it was out of sync with global expectations for other developed nations. And what that did is it changed what's called the yen carry trade. And so the Japanese economy for a very, very long time has had exceedingly low interest rates. And so the play on this from an investment standpoint is you borrow, you create debt for yourselves in Japan with a very low interest rate. And then you use that to buy anything else in a different sovereign currency. And that happened, what's today's date, 9th or 10th? So it happened 9 days ago. And what happened is it created a strengthening of the yen and against the dollar, and that created a trigger for other nations in the U.S. to go ahead and say, well, the Japanese market's selling off a lot, and the Japanese market sold off, I think, 13, 12% that day, about 20% over the course of the last week. And that single day was Japan's biggest decline since the 1987 Black Monday that some people may remember or at least have heard of.
Yeah.
And so that was the trigger here in the U.S. I can't say it's the unwinding of the Japanese carry trade, but it was a move toward the unwinding of the Japanese carry trade. And by the way, it's not unwound. I mean, it's still a significant rate differential.
But it's the increase of fear of what might happen because of that, right? And there's also the long-running narrative right now of a soft landing in the economy. And that's been talked about for a long time. Obviously, there was a big spike up in interest rates over the last few years, and those have come down. And the Fed has increased their rates, which affects all the other rates in the market, over again a short period of time, and then kept them steady, and everyone's sort of expecting that Fed rate cut, which will, so it seems like it's just this narrative that's built in, and when something goes against the narrative, that's when the stock market wants to say, okay, I'm out. And I think about the jobs number that also came out last week, right? That was counter to the narrative of that soft landing. It was more jobs lost or fewer jobs gained, I guess, than were expected.
Yeah, so quickly, the recession side. Mm-hmm. The Fed, and by recession side, I mean the past expectations, because I'll do it briefly because it sets up context for the future conversation. Yeah, it was probably not imprudent for some folks to think that a recession was going to come because the Federal Reserve did raise rates fairly rapidly. I had suggested that we already had a recession. If you look back in first two quarters of 2023, there's two negative quarters of growth. That's a weird thing to say, negative quarters of right. growth, but that's how we say it in the industry, you know, contraction. And that's, you know, it's not the official definition of a recession, but it was close enough for me.
Yeah.
And so I never thought that we were going to have a recession at that period of time. I do think that we are going to have a recession, and we can talk a little bit about that. But now there's a lot of, and then in the end of 2023, there was consensus expectations the Fed would come in and cut rates six times, each time 25 basis points, one quarter of one percentage point, throughout 2024. And the word I used to describe that, and I used this word a lot, was absurd. It just was way too much. I had originally, in the beginning of 2024, said, hey, maybe we'll get one in December. I don't think they should do it at all. It now sort of looks like they're going to do it in September.
Mm.
And there's a lot of people saying we should do it now because, you know, a recession is imminent if we're not already in a recession. Mm. And so and a big trigger of that, some of that conversation, was the fact that last Friday, the jobs report came in lower than expected. It wasn't bad. It was net new gains.
Yeah.
I'm struggling to figure out why a lot of people were so dismayed at that number. It was something like 114,000 jobs that were gained, you know, but the 3-month moving average is about, I think, 170,000.
Hmm.
These are net jobs, by the way, not gross jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And net, the amount of new entrants into the labor force per month is about 160,000. So you're still seeing more jobs created than people entering the labor force.
Right. So that doesn't necessarily indicate a recession at that point if people are still getting jobs, net new jobs, right? You don't want to see the opposite, which is how many jobs were lost. I mean, then you know you're in a recession of some kind.
Yeah, and so here's a tricky thing about that, though. And actually, just to put an exclamation point on people's knee-jerk reaction,
sure.
there's one economist who I track and follow and I respect a lot. His name is Jeremy Siegel,
mm-hmm.
Professor at the Warren School, is a Nobel Prize laureate. And shortly after that jobs report, he's like, the Fed has to come in and do an emergency cut of 75 basis points, like right away.
Yeah, that seems like a knee-jerk reaction for
and then,
sure.
Yeah,
right?
Then last night he's like, you know what? I'm sorry. I don't know what I was thinking. Basically, I'm paraphrasing, but I mean, that's also a sign of a smart guy is to have an opinion, and to say, you know what? Now they reflect upon further data, it's probably not right. But the jobs reports are great tools because they're coincident indicators that can tell you where you are or not. And there's a very popular rule right now called the SOM rule, and it's being talked about a lot. It's named after former Federal Reserve economist Claudia Sahm.
Okay.
And she came up with, she was actually trying to come up with a policy tool, not a tool for monetary policy, but a tool to let government officials know, hey, maybe you want to do something on the fiscal side because we're in a recession. So instead of predicting a recession, it's, hey, are you in a recession? I won't get into the math of it too much, but essentially it's a 3-month moving average of the unemployment rate at its low. And if it goes up 0.5%, within a year, then you're not predicting a recession, but rather in a recession.
Wow.
And that has been true every single time.
Hmm.
And after the last jobs report, here's another reason why people said, oh no, we're in a recession, is actually got triggered. So it went from 0.43 to 0.53, where 0.5 was a threshold for recession. So using Claudia's rule, the SOM rule, we would expect to be in recession now. Now, SOM herself has come out and said, listen, and I love that she's doing this. She's thinking like a scientist more than an economist who wants to claim fame based on her eponymous rule. Because scientists will say, listen, we built a model, But models, by their very definition, don't always work.
Right.
They're a great guide, but not necessarily a hard and fast rule, even if you want to call it a rule. Yeah. And you know, she suggests that because of the reshaping of the labor force post-economy, the number of immigrants that have come into the workforce, that this time it's not as clear as a signal as it might have been in the past. Mm. But once you had that weaker-than-expected jobs report last Friday, it triggered the SOM rule, and a lot of people said, give me some cuts now.
Yeah. And I also think, too, and I see how sometimes this works on a Thursday or a Friday, where some bad news comes out and it sort of gets churned around in people's thoughts. And then the markets close on Friday and they've got the whole weekend to think about it. And it feels like that's the worst thing in the world, right? Because immediately they're just saying, okay, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? They're all, you know, just, and then Monday hits and it's just straight down. And it's kind of what we saw on Monday with that 1,000-point Dow drop. And again, it's just a number. Actually, in percentage terms, it's certainly nowhere near the largest drop in the Dow that we've ever seen. It's just, I guess, eye-popping when you see the 1,000 number, right?
That round number does smack you in the face for sure.
I just wonder about that weekend effect. And then the Fed, looking at those things, they're not going to make that knee-jerk reaction, right? That's not part of their mandate. The Fed has two mandates, right, to follow, and following the markets or following politics, not supposed to be one of those.
Yeah, so there are two mandates. One is stable growth, and the other is stable prices. Mm. And I think it's correct for the Fed to start thinking about the stable growth right now. Like I said earlier on in the year, I said I don't think they should have raised the interest rates at all, and I still don't think that they should, but they have cover to. Mm. And my job isn't to think about what they should do. I guess they start with what they should do, but then I convert that thought into what they will do. And you know, the last four quarters of gross domestic product GDP, which is a broad measure of the U.S. Economy, has been averaged 3.125%. Currently, the Atlanta Fed has a tracker for GDP, and it's at 2.9%. It's early in the quarter, but that's a pretty good number. It'll probably change. It'll definitely change in the next couple months.
But those are healthy GDP numbers for the U.S., right?
Yeah. I mean, so trend growth changes over time, but you know, you call it 2% trend just to put a ballpark in there, some relative basis. So the Fed, I feel, doesn't need to cut rates, and I feel that they could hold rates longer and make sure inflation is it does come down further. But they don't need to do that. And here's why they don't need to do that. Most people tend to look at what's called the Consumer Price Index, the CPI. But the Fed looks at what personal consumption and expenditures is, PCE. Mm. And they look at the core side of it, which removes the core means it strips out the volatile food and energy components of it.
Those two things that we all have to buy, food and energy.
Yeah. So, by the way, it's such shenanigans on it. Because, yes, I will say energy prices are absolutely volatile. But the food prices were stripped out in the 70s because they were battling inflation way back then. Mm. Inflation was running so high that they said, let's take out food because it's going so high, so it looks like we're doing a better job. And they always kept it out of core. Huh. But that's still what we look at now.
Yeah.
And that's at 2.6% year over year, but the Fed's target's at 2%. Now, the Fed said they will cut rates before they hit 2%. Because you have a trajectory that goes toward that. And the labor market, while I mentioned earlier, is not a problem. It is normalizing. It's, you know, quarterly growth, the monthly growth for the last 3 months is 170,000, whatever it was. Last year, 2023, is 255,000. So it's normalizing. The ratio of jobs and those looking for jobs and jobs postings are normalizing. But the Fed, here's another reason why the Fed has cover to cut rates. The CPI and PCE both have a shelter component, housing. Mm. And it's not done the same way other developed nations do it. The Fed uses what's called owner's equivalent rent, and that's basically equivalent of them calling me up and saying, hey, how much would you rent that in-law house you have in back, or maybe the basement, how much would you rent it out for? Mm. And the respondents say, I don't know, $5,000. Mm. And they use that. And it's not actual real data. They have access to actual real data for rents. And so if you were to what's called harmonize PCE by replacing owner's equivalent rent, this made up survey, with actual numbers, the Fed's inflation rate, PCE, the core component has been below 2% for 12 months now.
Wow.
So they have, you know, but they can't say, they say that and move the goalpost because then they lose their credibility.
Mm-hmm.
But they have plenty of cover to cut rates. They just don't necessarily need to.
Yeah. And then there's the whole election year component, right? Which there's a lot of talk about whether the Fed looks at that and says, well, we can't cut rates or we can't make big moves during an election year because we'll be seen as political of making that to help one candidate or to hurt another candidate, and especially in a presidential election year. You think there's any truth to that? Do you think they look at that?
Well, I think they look at a lot of things when it comes to politics. And I do believe that, like any human being whose job it is to be objective about something, tries to stay as objective as possible. But we are all influenced by our environment and surroundings, our decisions, whether it's conscious or subconscious.
Hmm.
And no matter what side of the aisle you're on, you know, President Trump has said, you know, basically, I don't like Jerome Powell. I don't want him in there anymore. So, you know, and Jerome Powell, by the way, is the governor of the Federal Reserve Board, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. So he knows he's out of a job if Trump wins. So, you know, he has every reason to juice the economy to make it look favorable for the Harris administration. I'm not saying he's going to do that. I'm just saying it's hard for human beings to not influence that, have that influence in their mind. That being said, I think they've been really great about being data dependent, and I don't think they're going to make a decision based on politics because it hasn't been their history. And even if one person, the chairman, has that subconscious influence, everyone else is going to hold them to task on their consideration.
Yeah. And then the data dependency that you just brought up is another thing, right? Is whether the Fed should be looking and, you know, sort of staying in that lane of just looking at the numbers and making decisions on the numbers, or whether they should be, you know, what do they say, skating to where the puck's going to be. If they know where things are headed, should they make changes earlier than the data that's coming in that's looking backward, right? That's another philosophical question.
Well, There's a little good news and a little bad news on that.
Hmm.
The bad news is it turns out that they're just as bad as everyone else when it comes to forecasting what the economy is going to do.
Where they say nobody knows nothing.
Yeah. but they have, you know, they've got, you know, 1,000+ economists, many of them, if not most of them, you know, PhDs. So, I mean, they have a real good team, but still, it's just really, it turns out that it's really, really hard to track what the economy is going to do, because whatever variables you put into your models, new variables change quickly. And even if you get the variables right, it's kind of like a chaos theory. You could get it precisely right, but the outcome of your prediction could be different. I'm not trying to put them off the hook, but the point is they try to, they just don't necessarily do it great. But they are trying to, in terms of reducing interest rates, to say, hey, we've effectively dealt with inflation. They have said, well, we're going to raise rates, I'm sorry, lower rates, excuse me, prior to hitting their 2% target on inflation, because they are going to try to project the trajectory and if the path is a sustainable one to go closer to their 2%. So they do try to predict what's going to go on.
And the Fed Board of Governors is not just one guy. Like, we think of Jay Powell as the guy who's lowering or raising interest rates, and it really isn't just him. There's a board of governors, right? And they're meeting and they're discussing this stuff. They have minutes to these meetings. Those are all, like, carefully scrutinized and things like that. But, you know, there's a vote, essentially, to whether, you know, it's going to go in one direction or the other.
Yeah, I think there's 12 Federal Reserve banks. And then there's a subcommittee called the Federal Open Market Committee that gets together. And even when they do all get the subcommittee gets together for the voting once every, I don't know, month and a half ish. Not all of them have voting rights. And then, so, but there are, you know, there's other people making decisions and other people weighing in on those decisions.
Yeah. So interesting. Alan Harris is my guest here this morning. If you're just tuning in, he's the CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Berkshire Money Management. And we're talking about the economy and money and the stock market and all kinds of other things. We're definitely going to hit AI in the second half of the show. But while we're talking about the recent volatility, let's bring it back to sort of an ordinary experience that somebody might have when they hear something like this that happens. The news hits them. Maybe they're not thinking about it, and all of a sudden they hear about that big number drop in the stock market, and they're suddenly paying attention. If they have an investment plan already, if they know, you know, so they have their 401k and their other investments, their savings, and all the, hopefully they're, you know, they've got it distributed in a way that, you know, it's not all the eggs in one basket. Is the best course of action to stay with that plan during times of volatility like this?
I'm going to give two answers. One is that if you're a passive investor, maybe a do-it-yourself investor, I mean, it's really hard to time the market reliably in terms of timing. So getting in is one thing, and then you have to figure out when to get back out, and vice versa. But you know, if someone were to come to me and ask, you know, should they do something on their own? Probably not. But if they were to ask me, what should I do if I was going to do something? I'd be like, well, that's an easy one for me. I can tell you what I'd think of doing. And here's what I'm considering doing, but I haven't pulled any actions yet. It is, you know, we're overweight. We use an instrument called QQQ, which essentially is a NASDAQ 100. We've got it's one of our biggest holdings. I think it's the second largest holding behind SPY, which is the S&P 500. And that's been, you know, great for us. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're not all that great, but those are our biggest holdings, and we're happy about that. You know, it's pretty easy for me to say, you know what? If the Fed is going to reduce rates, so we can probably, for more conservative investors, raise some cash and buy some bonds with it. Because if interest rates are going down, let's lock in the bonds, and then we'll have the appreciation of those bonds when they go down. And for more moderate investors, we can go ahead and think about some investments that will be lower volatility for just the next few months as we get up to and through elections. August and October historically are the most volatile months of the year. I have got no reason to think that, you know, we're going to have such great upside that I'd feel like, oh, opportunity lost if I were to make a subtle shift, a small subtle shift to something lower beta meaning less volatile for the next few months. But if
and
you're more,
and we expect that choppiness basically between August and October.
But if you're more, I guess, aggressive investor, just hold on to it. I mean, any given year, you should expect. Well, it's on average, so it's a weird number, but 3.5-5% corrections per year. So, and you forget about them. Right. This one that we just had, I think the S&P was down 8.5%. I think it was a third this year, and I bet you most people don't remember the other 2-5% pullbacks.
I couldn't tell you when they happened.
Yeah, just because we kind of forget about them.
Yeah.
And then once every 14 months, there's a 10% pullback. Every few years, there's a 20% plus. Unfortunately, it do happen.
That's a big one, right?
That's a big one.
That's the bear market when we get to the 20%.
Our intent is to try to either avoid or mitigate those, but kind of ride through for the most part the 5 or 10%, except for, like I said, maybe some small, subtle changes on the outside of it.
Yeah. And I think about investor Warren Buffett also, who, many people know will hoard the cash for a long time when he thinks that the markets are overbought, right? When there's no good deals to be had. And then I think about what happened during the recession of 2008, where he swooped in and was able to pick up some pretty nice deals while everyone else was fearful and selling off.
He's been in the news a lot lately because he reduced his Apple position from about 40% to 20%. And people might be like, oh my goodness, they sold half of his Apple. What should we take from that? Well, I think you should take two things. Number one is don't hold 40% of your portfolio in one stock, no matter how good it was. I mean, he's 9x his money. He did great. That's just smart to go. I mean, maybe we could argue 20% is too much, but going from 40% to 20% is just smart thinking. Yeah. But then the other side is kind of what you said. Like, okay, what's the other takeaway? Well, he's got $250 million worth of cash. Well, you know, it's easier to hold cash now than it was in 2019, because in 2019 you're getting nothing in your cash. Right. You can sit at 5% interest rates right now and just kind of wait and see what happens.
Yeah. And I think we're going to talk about interest rates in the second half of the show also, and how those are can be good in terms of the savings accounts, as you talked about, but also where we are with the cycle of that, because it almost feels like we've peaked a little bit there, and we're maybe heading down the other side of that cycle. So we'll talk to Alan Harris about that more in the second half of the program. Stick around, folks. This is Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM, and we will be back after our short little top of the hour break that we always take, and we'll be back after this. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Hello, this is Congressman Richard E. Neal, and you're listening to 89.7 WTBR FM Pittsfield Community Radio.
Support for WTBR comes from the Office of Cultural Development in Pittsfield. The next First Fridays at 5 is September 6th, featuring a family fun zone, Maker's Market, live music, entertainment, and more. For more details, go to lovepittsfield.com and UCP of Western Mass. Turn passion into purpose when you apply at UCP of Western Mass, now offering full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. It's more than just a job, it's our identity. Apply today at ucpwma.org/jobs.
At Pittsfield Community Television, we have a saying, anyone can learn to create television. With the support of trained production staff, we can teach you how to professionally operate a camcorder, use editing software to tell a story, work as a team in a production studio, and take those skills into the community. If you've been curious as to how video production works, we'd love to have you as a member. Visit us online at pittsfieldtv.org or call us at 445-4234 for more information.
Let's take a moment to talk about your wellness. Financial wellness, that is.
Go through the process of making a monthly budget, even if it's not perfect. It's good to be aware of your financial health.
When shopping for insurance, ask your agent to shop around for you and see if you can bundle your policies.
This money hack brought to you by your neighbors at Greylock Federal Credit Union. All financial education and coaching resources are free and open to the public. Greylock Federal Credit Union, insured by NCUA.
Every Sunday night at 10 p.m., something strange happens to the airwaves of WTBR-FM. It's called The Mix. It is an experience like no other on this part of the planet. Witness a collection of fresh and classic beats that are guaranteed to make you move. The best part is, it is mixed completely live, uncut, unedited. So, for an exciting end to the weekend, tune your radio to WTBR-FM Sunday nights from 10 to midnight for The Mix.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. BCC provides access to higher education to everyone in Berkshire County and beyond, offering more than 50 high-quality programs, small class sizes, and an affordable education to help their students of all ages achieve their dreams. At BCC, their middle name is Community. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings, and screen rooms. Customized solutions available online at Sandrini.com.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR. And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Yes, welcome back to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you live and local in our WTBR studio this morning. Glad to have you aboard for the show. I hope you've enjoyed the first half. If you're just joining us, we have CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Berkshire Money Management, Alan Harris, here with us today, talking about money and the markets. And we're going to probably get into AI and some things like that and business cycles. All kinds of good stuff coming up in the second half of the show, so stick around for that. First, let's go to the National Weather Service forecast to find out what is in store. I'm looking out the window right now, and I'm seeing the sun. I don't know. I was hearing about rain today. So let's see what we've got in store.
Berkshire weather.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Today, cloudy. A chance of showers with a slight chance of thunderstorms this morning. Then showers with a chance of thunderstorms this afternoon. Highs in the upper 70s. Southeast wind 15 to 20 miles per hour. Gusts up to 35 miles per hour this afternoon. Chance of rain 80%. Tonight, showers with a chance of thunderstorms in the evening, then showers likely after midnight. Locally heavy rainfall possible in the evening. Humid with lows in the mid-60s. South wind 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Becoming southwest with gusts up to 30 miles per hour after midnight. Chance of rain 90%. Saturday, mostly sunny. Highs around 80. West wind 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
Okay, there you have it. And we do have some rain coming in for sure. So enjoy the sun if you're seeing it right now. It's not going to last. maybe some breaks here and there, but mostly rain and some wind, it sounds like also. But then we're going to get a nicer day tomorrow with some highs around 80. So kind of like that. All right, welcome back to the show again. Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM. Alan Harris, my guest. Thanks again for being here, Alan.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Always good talking to you about money, and it's one of those things that everybody has to be concerned about, whether it's the everyday spending or the economy and your job or your investments or anything like that. It's go ahead.
Didn't mean to talk about it, but even where you're spending, we were talking about that earlier on. Yeah. You know, Big Lots are going to close down some shops and stores and perhaps file bankruptcy, and we're talking about how, you know, different corporate results for different businesses can be telling. So I mean, it being telling along different economic strata and income levels, and so, you know, people on the lower side are definitely getting pinched with inflation and having to make some real hard decisions.
Yeah, and some of those, as you mentioned, brick and mortar stores have had a tough go. Right, we know of many name brand stores that have gone away, and just Bed Bath and Beyond, for example, and some of the things that happened in the 08 recession. The economy seems to wash those out after a while. If they can't survive, they go away. And certainly the online shopping revolution, you know, from the last 20 years has really impacted the way that we buy things, the way that stores sell them, how they attract customers and all that stuff. So technology itself does have a huge impact on our everyday lives. Things that we grew up knowing are kind of fading away in some ways.
And it's interesting. Some of the things that we grew up with technology-wise were the people who use what we take for granted now, those who were early adopted were like, you know, revolutionary pioneers at the time. I mean, email, for example, became more widespread use 94, 95, something like that. Mm-hmm. I tend to be a better librarian than a library, so I'll say some things that are roughly correct, but I tell you right now, whatever numbers I say, you can probably fact check it. I'm going to be close, but off a little bit. But at the time, there was a real pioneering thing.
Right.
And now you wouldn't, you know, you probably send or receive 50 emails a day.
Right. And yet the other thing that people sort of predicted was the demise of the U.S. Postal Service and other shipping and things like that with the email. They said, well, people send emails. They won't send letters anymore. And in fact, what's happened is because of the online shopping revolution, there's so much more being sent in the mail and UPS and FedEx probably than ever before, right? Right to consumers. So it can have different effects.
Yeah, that has been sort of the history of technology, which is there's a fear of whatever change is going to come, but we forget about that fear later on because whatever replaced that fear usually is some level of technological progression that we adapt into our lives and enjoy. And then at some point, take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say take for granted like in a mean or disparaging way, but it just blends into our life so seamlessly that we forget the magic of it.
Until it's gone, right?
Yeah.
Like you only notice the you need power when the power is out because it's just expected that you grow. I know in a blackout, a lot of times I'll go over and try to switch a light on. And I'm like, it's a blackout. There's no power, but I'm just
reflexively
conditioned into doing that. So in things like that, what do they say when you lose the electricity? You're back in the 1800s. If you lose the internet, you're back in the 1900s. So we certainly do. We forget because it just becomes ingrained in your daily lives. And we'll talk about AI and sort of the what we're heading for there, because we're only just dipping our toe in the water, aren't we, right now?
Yeah, because that does fold into the fear conversation about what's going to happen with it, for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's go into that. And I do want to talk about the Magnificent Seven stocks also, which are tied into the AI revolution in a lot of ways, right? They're fates for these big companies that have seen huge stock increases are tied to their futures with AI, how well they will meet the AI challenge of the future, whether they'll be ready to take advantage of it and make multiple upon multiple of their money. So let's talk about, let's strip it down to AI first and say, why is the coming AI revolution going to be so important? Why are we talking about it?
Sure. So AI, short for artificial intelligence, what's the first thing to start about artificial intelligence is there's no really strong agreed upon language artificial intelligence is. Because artificial intelligence has existed for a while, depending on how you want to define it. You know, one of the most frequently used tools that we all use is predictive text. So that's AI.
Yep. So when you're typing on your cell phone, someone's texting, the phone knows that the next word you're going to say is, you know, predictable.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is hit space or tab or whatever, and now you've got that word. You didn't have to type it out.
Yep.
Yeah.
Prior to that is, you know, you get in Adobe or even just on your desktop screen, Control F, and then you type in what you want to find, and it finds that text. That's artificial intelligence. More recently, self-driving cars, or at least, you know, not necessarily even FSDs, full self-driving cars, but if you have a Tesla, you can go ahead and take your hands off the wheel and it'll navigate for you. That's artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
So, I mean, artificial intelligence, depending how you want to define it, has been around and used by us for a while, but it's become more of the zeitgeist end of 2023-ish when OpenAI announced its then latest version of ChatGPT, and then Microsoft pumped $80 billion into it, or a valuation of $80 billion. I forget what it was, but yeah, a lot of money. I think it was like $20 billion, a valuation of $80 billion, something like that. And so it became a lot of conversation about it. This is when people started using it, and ChatGPT ended up having more signed on users in like a month's period of time than any other platform in history, whether it's Facebook or Instagram. So it was really high adoption, really quick.
So the word got around quickly. People said, I want to try this out. Well, what is all this I hear about ChatGPT? Let's see what it can do for me, right?
Well, the more people use it in things like Midjourney or 11 Midjourney as AI for visuals, 11 AI for audio, people are like, wow, this is crazy cool. And so, you know, it's a little bit of, became a little bit of a game in some ways for people to go ahead and take a look at it. So what is the fear about it? This is going to sound like I'm making fun of it or trying to be silly, but I don't think it's too far-fetched for me to say some of the concern is a very Terminator type of thing, like artificial intelligence taking
like
over.
Skynet,
basically. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like what's going to happen? Because that's what. So those who don't recall, Arnold Schwarzenegger in the mid-1980s was starting a movie called Terminator, where he sent back from time to kill Sarah Connor. And the reason this all happened is because of artificial intelligence. It became smart enough to code itself and develop itself and become faster and smarter than human consciousness and sort of took over. And so you had a lot of people who were sort of fearful of that. Now, that's... like I said, a little bit of hyperbole, but there was some concern about what's going to, the fear of the unknown. Like AI is this smart at that version of AI of ChatGPT. And by the way, now we've got Claude, Perplexity, Meta's Llama, and they're so much better than they were a year ago because I've played with them. They're amazingly better.
Wow.
So the thought process, they were so good. And there's a in semiconductors manufacturing, there's something called the Moore's Law, computing power. Just it gets like half as cheap and twice as strong and over the course of a year.
Yeah.
If we can apply that to AI and these large language models, where is it going to take us? Like it's almost unfathomable,
right?
Just based on how cool it is.
Hard to project out that far what could be, what could happen by that time.
So you have that apocalyptic concern by some. And that kind of stuff was kind of fun for, I guess, journalists and media to kind of present. So you had that run with it.
Right.
But then you have more, I'll call it sober, realistic concern about, okay, how am I going to lose my job sort of thing. And as we're talking about before we got on air, everybody in every industry feels the most fear based on their job because, of course, it impacts them the most. One of us is going to be right. One industry is going to be right. It's going to impact them the most. But
and those industries want to be ready for it, I suppose,
yes,
right?
Yes. But I think in the near intermediate term, it's going to be not who AI is going to replace, but who in which industry is going to say, how am I going to best use these tools to improve what we do, to stay ahead of our competition? The AI, I think, is going to be better for corporations to offer services to companies than it is going to be a destroyer of companies. And so, there's a lot of different tools that are out there to use, but for me, I can quickly scan estate planning documents and then get a synopsis of them, or I can record a conference on my Plug device and then have it a synopsis of it in like 0.5 seconds and like super well bullet pointed.
So it's making you more efficient, essentially.
Right? So much more efficient.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things that you'd mentioned in your recent Berkshire Eagle article was that it's going to affect a lot of businesses at the margins, right? And that might be the most power of AI, maybe in the long term, is what it can benefit for you to make those efficiencies just a little bit better, to make a little bit more profit, right? To be able to make your business better.
Yeah. So we'll talk about the S&P 500 companies, the companies in the S&P 500, just because they're public companies and it's well documented. So it won't translate specifically to private companies and small companies, for example, here in the Berkshires. But the last 5-year average for S&P 500 companies for profit margins is 11.5%. More recently, it's like 12.3%. Now, a good portion of that is when corporations went on a hiring spree a couple of years ago, it took some time to train and onboard those employees. Mm-hmm. But you're really beginning to see, if you survey folks that are out there, and actually in the article reference, there was a survey of consultants, and they're finding like meaningful improvements in their capacity loads and their efficiency throughout the day. And so whether that ends up adding a percentage or two, I don't know. But there's no way on earth that we don't see greater efficiency from these tools, because we're already seeing them. The people who are already using them are seeing them. The key is to be, whether you want to be that email user in 1994 or you're going to be the email user in 2002, like when you're going to start using this thing that is so ubiquitous, that is now so seamless in our life that we all use, whether it's a large language model or software that is using AI.
Well, it feels like at some point everyone will be using it, whether they know it or not, right? And that's the other thing, is that so much of AI is already being worked in and through with some of the technology that you're already interacting with, whether it's something on your Facebook feed or whether it's something from a government organization or whatever. I mean, the government organizations might be a little more slow to adopt. I don't know. But certainly if businesses are using that to improve their business, their efficiency, their product line, their marketing, any of those things, those are things that the end user is also technically using because it's come through the pipeline, right?
Well, you mentioned Facebook. We'll talk about them specifically. Yeah. There's going to be different companies that actually from an investment side are going to become more attractive because they get better at what they do. So Meta's primary revenue is ads. And so they get better at selling ads if they're better, if they can target the ads better. And so they're using their large language model and all the chips that they're, GPUs, graphic processing units they're buying from NVIDIA to say, hey, how can we best target potential buyers so that we can sell more ads in a higher price? So they're using that.
Yeah.
Companies like Adobe, they're doing more and more on the graphic side themselves and doing more and more on the search side. They're going to go ahead and be able to have a higher profit margin, which is going to be great for investors. And those of us who sit around, like, I use Grammarly. I've used Grammarly for 5, 6, 7 years. I've lost track of it. So Grammarly is a cool tool where I do a lot of writing. And what you do is basically import your Word document into Grammarly. And it says, yeah, nice try, but you forgot your comma here and you misspelled this. And so
your 11th grade teacher is shaking.
Exactly. So I'm able to, just with a simple import, go ahead and look at all the grammatical errors that it had in Shape Up. Now, it's not perfect because I end up having Kim at the office like do it once over, even after I do Grammarly. It's like she'll catch a couple things. Yeah. But, you know, it'll clean it up significantly.
Yeah.
And so there's things that we can use to make our work life a lot easier.
Yeah.
And so we can – it's actually – so it's great for, yes, business-wise in terms of dollars and cents. But it also allows us to spend more time on the things that we'd prefer to spend time on.
Yeah.
So if you're a small business operator, you know that, you know, you're the proverbial jack of all trades and you wear these many hats and, you know, you got into the business because you're really good at one thing, but now you're stuck doing all these other things.
Well, and sometimes because you have to, right?
Yeah, yeah, because you have to. Until you hire and build out sort of a larger infrastructure,
right.
Well, you can end up outsourcing through software that uses AI to help you with, you know, whether it happens to be an administrative task or calling, scheduling, what it happens to be.
Yeah, all the stuff that you'd rather have a machine do than a person do. Yeah. We're speaking with Alan Harris, the CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Berkshire Money Management. This is Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR FM. And, you know, there are lots of positive outlooks for AI. Certainly, we'll see that, just like we saw with the internet boom, and we remember the 90s about how much promise there was about the internet, and now here we are in 2024, and hey, the internet is the internet. It's just part of our daily lives. There is no doubt about that. So they were right, back in the 90s, that the internet would be eventually, you know, this major force in our lives, for good and bad, right? And so we're looking at AI it's sort of in that same light in some ways, and there are some probably dark sides, downsides to AI that we can all think about. We think of deep fakes, for example, and you know, misinformation, disinformation, especially around a presidential election, things like that. Will the good outweigh the bad in the long term, you think, with AI?
Yeah, and here's the difficulty with it, though, because you don't necessarily know what that is going to look like. So let's go back to like automobiles.
Sure.
So it's very easy to point out what the downside is going to be, but it's more difficult to say here's what the upside is going to be because you don't know what the consequences are going to be on the upside.
Mm.
So I'm pretty darn sure when the automobile came around and there was a buggy whip manufacturer
in
the
probably last in Westfield.
In the very and I bet you that last buggy whip manufacturer was the best in the game at doing what they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And but then, you know, no more buggies, so no more need for buggy whips.
Right.
And people said, "What about all the buggy whips being manufacturers being put out of business?" Well, number one, good because I don't like you whipping horses, so good for you for being put out of business. But number two, it's. You had to think about and embrace all the other things that were going to happen in terms of interstate commerce, car manufacturers. Are you going to be able to get to, are you going to have a better deployment of the labor workforce because you can go somewhere else and further to go to a different job? And
that would have been unimaginable, right, at
yeah.
that time, to imagine that we would have the interstate highway system, for example, or all the things that brought along.
Yep. And even more recently, so you see at supermarkets now a lot of checkout kiosks, and I remember people being up in their arms about it's taking away the jobs and people who are, you know, doing that work. Well, mm-hmm. they've found different work.
Mm-hmm.
So and that's just been the history for 150, 200 years here in the U.S. When a new technology comes in, some jobs might be replaced, but other jobs are created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I'm sure that's what the largest companies that are betting on AI are thinking, right? And that's the next thing is we think about students coming up through middle school, high school, thinking about careers that they might have. And that seems to shift and change over the years as well, right? We thought about how important coding was for a while, I think about. And now we're even talking about that as maybe something that could suffer from AI, because why do you need someone who can code when a machine can do that in a fraction of the time, you know, at least for some of the basic things that need to be done with computer coding?
Well, here's how quickly that changes. And if you remember the story better than me, jump in. But there was a phrase, you know, learn to code, that was used sort of obnoxiously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So if you know, if you were going to be put out of a job because of some change in technology, someone would say, learn to code. And it was, you know, someone said that on Twitter or something like that. It got carried over and over as sort of this, like, I don't know, real jerky thing to say for someone, basically. And now with There's actually specific AI companies. I was just listening to a podcast yesterday, and I forget what they're called, whose job it is not to just have AI, but to use it to be able to use AI to code. Mm. So those of who are, you know, felt really good about, hey, I can always have my job forever because they can learn to code. And I'm, you know, so I'm not trying to be a jerk. I'm only trying to be a jerk who said to the people who said learn to code, not to the people who actually code. But now those people actually have a threat of a technology coming in displacing what they do.
Yeah.
And so they'll have to figure out what else to do. And that might be a 10-year away problem from now, but you know, it is a that'll come to roost at some point.
Yeah. And some of the skills needed to, it's a sort of the thought process of what it means to code something and to, you know, write in a computer language will still apply. It's just that you may need to reassess where you're going to apply those skills, right? And it might be more in the, you know, assisting or working with AI to create the same kind of product. End result is people still need products. They still need either physical products or they need software products to run their businesses, to run their lives, things like that. Those will always be needed.
Yeah, so here's the interesting things. You mentioned the Magnificent Seven earlier on, yeah. Which are the seven largest companies in the S&P 500, which are heavily tech games. It includes a company called NVIDIA, which sells graphic processing units, which are used to help companies build what's called large language models, which are like ChatGPT mm-hmm. and Claude and Perplexity. And they sell to companies heavily, their biggest customers being Amazon, Meta, Google, and
some of those companies are in the Magnificent Seven too.
Yes, but
it's the NVIDIA that seems to be that laser focus on why is NVIDIA so important? It's because they make the chips that make this stuff possible.
They build sort of the infrastructure. Yeah. They've been compared to the Cisco systems back in the 1990 thing, where they're building the picks and shovels, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about what we're just talking about, these different ways to use AI, is, you know, the some of the biggest beneficiaries may be from all the capital expenditure from the Big Seven, the Magnificent Seven, and how the smaller companies can use large language models and APIs to go ahead and build a software system that is useful for small companies and individuals to be better at their job and be more efficient at their job. Because right now, and we're talking about this before, I believe it was off air, about, is there going to be a return on the investment?
Mm. So that's the big question, right? If you've got investments in these big companies because at the time they were, you know, skyrocketing upward, it seemed like there was no end. And now it seems like maybe there's a bit of a rotation into some different kinds of companies, smaller companies, or maybe not. Who knows, right?
Yeah.
But it does seem like, you know, is that a wise investment now?
Well, is it a wise investment for the individual or is it a wise investment for the company? Let's start with the company, because if it's a good investment for the company, it could be for the individual. And now the good news for those large companies with all the expenditures is that they're so large that it's not going to put them out of business. Mm. But it's something like $180 billion the last year or something, a CapEx spend on GPUs and other AI infrastructure. So what are the returns? Oh my God, nothing, basically. and it's not completely true.
At least short term, nothing.
Yeah,
right?
Short term. So they're of the large language model, because they're spending the most money, these companies, on building their large language models. And ChatGPT is the most popular of the bunch, and they've got about $3 billion of revenue, which is a lot. Don't get me wrong, it's a lot, but compared to $180 billion of spend in totality, that's not just from Microsoft, who owns OpenAI, or has a partnership with them, I should say. And then it drops off, like, exceedingly, to, I think, $400 million for Claude.
Wow.
And I say I think because that's still a private company, so there's just been some extrapolation of what that might be. So you're not really seeing for those large companies the ROAI, I call it, instead of ROI, or return on investment, or return on artificial intelligence spending. You're not really seeing that yet.
So it's a big bet, basically. It's a big bet on the future where that will eventually make money. Is it making money right now compared to the capital spend? No.
It seems like a crazy bet to me.
Yeah?
Yeah. It'd be hard for me to think about spending. Let's make things more...
At least at those valuations, right? Yeah, buying NVIDIA basically as high as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I if you were to put... So let's add Claude together with ChatGPT and get $3.5 billion of revenue, and you spend $180 billion to generate $3.5 billion of revenue with it. I don't know.
Although if you go back in the internet.com bubble, if you were to pick that one company probably be Amazon, right? Out of all the ones, the dot-com era, I think of Intel crashing, you know, Cisco, not a big deal anymore. All the AOL, all those big names. Amazon somehow has survived.
Well, with the power of hindsight, I can pick
that's
that.
That's easy, right? Yeah. If it were only so easy. Alan Harris, I want to thank you so much for being here today. Believe it or not, our time is running short. But it's been a great conversation, as it always is, about things in the economy, the markets, AI, fascinating conversation. I hope our listeners have found it interesting as well.
I hope so, too. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks. We'll have you do it again. Next time we have more market volatility, I'm sure. That's
I can guarantee you that's going to happen. So I'll be right around the corner.
That's right. All right, everybody. Hope you had a great listen today to the show, and hope you have a great weekend. Stay away from those puddles today. Not too bad. We can deal with it. And then kind of a nice weekend coming up. Take care, everybody.